everybody. Welcome to my podcast. My name is Simca Fisher. And today I realized that this podcast is a little belated, but that's because I've been working on getting a special guest for you. I'd like to introduce to you my father, Phil Prever. And the reason that I've harassed him into appearing on my podcast this week is because this past week was the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War in Israel. And my father was there for some reason. And I've heard little scraps of it, and I have, little stories here and there, and I thought I would like to talk to my father and find out what the heck happened, and what he was doing there, and what it was like, and and that kind of thing. So I'm just gonna go ahead and jump right in, Abba. I know that this was in 1967, correct?
Right.
Yeah, and you'd been married for a couple of years by this point. You're in your early 20s. You had Dever and Abby.
4 or 5 years.
Four or 5 years. You had two little kids.
Two girls.
And you decided that it made sense to get on a ship and go to Israel.
Yeah, in 1966, summer of 1966, we went to Israel with our two children. And we lived in, it was Kiryat Yovel, which was a suburb of West Jerusalem. Jerusalem was divided at that time. And we lived in a hostel that was set up for prospective immigrants.
Oh, so it was all immigrants that lived there.
Men.
And how many people? How many people were there?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I'm sorry, the connection is terrible. How many people were you living with? How big of a setup was it?
Oh, there were probably like 30 or 40 families there. It was a big building.
Were they all Americans or from other places?
No, they were from all around the world. The woman next door was from Turkey, and people were from all over.
I'm just trying to imagine the scene. How much Hebrew did you know at the time?
Not much. but all the Israelis I met wanted to practice their English on me.
Yeah.
So I didn't learn much Hebrew while I was there. I had studied it in America before we left. We knew we were going to go.
Yeah.
And I took kind of a crash course. I knew enough to get by. I sounded like a 3-year-old child.
Yeah.
That's what I had.
Do you remember any of it?
Do I remember any of the Hebrew?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, let's hear something.
I remember in connection with the Six-Day War, I remember one word specifically, which is shul shul.
Which means what?
Now, which means diarrhea.
Oh, so not a happy war then.
because there was a long build up to this war.
Yeah.
Through the month of May, the president of Egypt, Abdul Nasser, had made all kinds of warlike moves. He had blockaded the southern port, the Israeli southern port of Eilat, and he had ordered these UN peacekeeping troops out of the Sinai, and they just got up and went.
Yeah.
Some peacekeepers. And so everybody could feel that war was coming, and there was a great nervousness over the whole country. And it manifested itself in shul shul. So everybody was talking about that.
Oh, my gosh.
That's one word I remember very distinctly in connection with this war.
Well, what the heck were you...
I don't know if I can...
I'm sure it'll come in handy sometime. What were you doing for work? How did you get a job? Did they have, like, a program for immigrants, or...?
Well... the Jewish agency gave me some help, but basically I had to go around. I was a librarian. I was educated as a librarian, and I went around by myself and applied for various jobs. And I ended up as cataloger in the Hebrew University Library, which was not too far from where we lived. And they needed somebody to catalog in English. Many of the works that they were adding to their collection were in English, so they needed somebody proficient in English, and I filled the bill. I had the right credentials.
Yeah.
So that's what I did for work.
And what did you do when you weren't at work? I'm wondering what the rest of your day was like. What would a typical day be like?
Well, I mean, I would get up in the morning, have breakfast, and go to work. We had a car for part of the time. Either that, or there was extensive bus service all through the area. And actually, we were close enough. If I got up early enough, I could walk there.
Yeah.
And I was there all day. There was no coming home for lunch. And I was there 6 days a week.
Oh.
We just had the one day a week off.
Yeah.
And that was a kind of a problem too, because that was Shabbos, the Sabbath.
Right.
And most everything was closed.
Right, right.
On the Sabbath. That was the one day off, so it somewhat restricted the activities you could do on that day off. You know, we had two young children, and we were raising them. I can't remember that we had a whole lot of activity.
Yeah.
I did have a relative in about a two-hour drive away in the city of Haifa. We visited them once. I can't remember.
It was 50 years ago. So
it was work 6 days a week. And
yeah.
And then. The Sabbath, there was not much going on because everything was closed.
Right.
So we used to travel around to see, you know, to see the country.
Right. Well, okay, we were sort of far into this interview here, and the question that I really, really, truly wanted to ask was, why did you go to Israel? Like, what was the thought there? What was the plan?
Well, I've tried to remember myself. We were not like committed Zionists or anything.
Yeah.
But we had a strong sense of Jewish identity, although we were certainly not religious Jews in any sense.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, Ima at the time was in correspondence with this Buddhist association in London. And I was delving into Eastern religions as well. So, but on the other hand, we had, I guess, as a young married couple with kids, life in America seemed kind of, I don't know, pointless, really.
Yeah.
We didn't seem to have much direction, and because of our Jewish family background, we thought that this might be something that would be add meaning to our lives. I guess that was really the motivation.
What did your parents and family think when you told them the plan?
They were not too thrilled. But they had mixed emotions.
Yeah.
They had some kind of pride, I suppose, that we were interested in Israel, although they weren't any more religious than we were, but they were not too thrilled about having their children and grandchildren, you know, thousands of miles away.
Sure.
And especially when the war drum started, we were getting constant messages that we should come home now.
Right.
And I kept saying, oh, don't worry, there's not going to be a war. Yeah. Like I knew anything.
Yeah.
I felt at the time, I remember feeling at the time that the United States would never permit it to come to actual shooting war.
Yeah.
But I didn't have really anything to base that on. That was just a feeling I had, and it turned out to be completely wrong.
Yeah. So when did you start to realize that it was really that you had to get out or start to think about getting out? Or how long had you been there, actually?
We had been there almost a year. And frankly, we weren't, as I mentioned, because of working 6 days a week and not really participating very much in the life of the country.
Yeah.
Whatever we thought we were going to find there, we failed to find, I must say.
Yeah.
So we were open to the idea of going home, back to America. And as the month of May went by, it became clearer and clearer that there was going to be a war. And the day that the war broke out, I was in Jerusalem, about a half a block from the border, which was the border with Jordan. And I was dealing with some bureaucrat in the customs department because we had brought a lot of household goods in with us, although they were in storage, and we had to get permission to get out because they considered us to be importers.
I've heard about the bureaucracy in Israel being especially intense.
It's Middle Eastern. It's one system piled on top of another, and it's very Byzantine, really.
Uh-huh.
So it was difficult. I had to get this permission, and I remember sitting in this office or a large room with different officials sitting at different desks. All of a sudden, on the radio, which was on at the time, an announcement out of nowhere comes out in Hebrew: the window is open. Shulchan Aruch, I think, something like that. The window is open. And half the people got up and walked out of the room.
Uh-oh.
I don't know where they went. But I realized this was some kind of coded message for people to report to their army base.
Oh, I see.
Because it was the civilian army.
Sure, yeah.
The population of Israel is very small, and the army is made up mostly of civilians.
Yeah.
Also, as I recall, the night before, we had seen tanks and military vehicles passing through the street right outside our window.
Oh, my gosh.
Towards the border.
Yeah.
And that was a sure sign that something was going on.
Yeah.
So we had decided to get out, but we decided too late.
Yeah.
And so soon after this exodus of the people from the office, the shooting began. And I was a half a block from the border. And everybody realized we couldn't just walk out into the street through the front door because there was a battle going on there. So I actually climbed out a back window down a fire escape ladder with a bunch of other people. And I did have a car at this time. I had an old Volkswagen bus. And we had to circle around through a circuitous route to get to it. And meanwhile, I mean, shells are landing all over the place, and bullets are flying. I've never been shot at in my life.
And your wife and two little kids are still back at home, not knowing what's going on. Oh my gosh!
Right. And it was something out of a movie, really.
Yeah.
So anyway, I got to my car and I took a bunch of people with me who also wanted to get out of town, and I went and I got back to the hostel, and by this time we realized that there was a war going on.
Yeah.
And it turned out that not too far from us, in the Jordanian border, they had let in a company of Egyptian artillery, and they were shelling Hadassah Hospital, which was about 2 miles away from us. And we could hear shells screaming overhead and explosions and everything. And also jet fighters in the sky screaming across the sky.
Oh, my gosh.
It was really, it was quite something, let's put it that way.
Holy mackerel.
And that night, we, because the hostel was one of the most well-built and solid buildings in that whole neighborhood, the authorities decided that it should be an air raid shelter for the people living in the neighborhood. And we had about 30 or 40 people in our apartment. You know, I mean, cheek by jowl, it wasn't much room. And, you know, it was a babble of languages there because, well, there were a lot of Israelis, too. And I one wonderful moment that I remember, we had the radio on, and they played the national anthem over the radio, and everybody sang it in in our apartment. We all sang it together, and I mean, people were crying. It was an emotional thing. And we didn't have a lot of information about what was going on. There was no television. We didn't even have a telephone, really. All we had was the radio, and most of the information we got over the radio was from the BBC. That was the best English language station that we could find. And the next day, I remember there were a lot. There was a lot going on in the sky. There was jet airplanes streaking across the sky all the time. But that stopped after the first day. And I found out soon afterwards the reason was that the Israeli Air Force had pretty much destroyed the Egyptian Air Force while it was on the ground. The Egyptians, well, let's put it this way. They talked big, but when it came to fighting, they weren't very good at it. I mean, they let their air force be destroyed on the ground.
Yeah, that's not too bad impressive.
You know, I mean, it kind of defeats the idea of an air force.
Now, I remember hearing you say that you said that you heard other people saying that people saw angels fighting on the side of Israel. Do you remember saying that?
Israeli Air Force pilots reported that they saw or felt angels fighting on their side.
Yeah.
I personally did not see it. And whether it happened or not, I'm perfectly willing to believe that it happened.
Yeah.
But I have no first-hand knowledge of that. But there definitely was a report of that. Another thing I remember from the early days, before the war and in the first day of the war, we could also hear radio from Jordan and Egypt in English.
Huh.
And I was astounded at the language that was being used. It was the most violent. The announcers were saying what the Arab armies were going to do to the Jews. They were going to rip them limb from limb. They were going to eat their children. They were going to rape their wives. All of this kind of talk was going on. And it was explained to me later that, I don't want to indulge in stereotypes here, but it was explained to me later that the Arab culture puts a lot of stock in big talk, you might say. And that's what we were experiencing then. And I remember hearing that. I did hear with my own eyes.
Yeah.
So
why was it in English? Was it for the benefit of Americans in Israel, or who was it for?
Apparently Rightly so.
Yeah.
Well, they did. They didn't broadcast in Hebrew.
Oh, right. That makes sense.
I think they were more likely to know English than they were to know Hebrew.
I see. So
I guess. I don't know. If it was in Arabic, I wouldn't have understood it. So I know it was in English because I heard it.
Because you heard it, right. So was it? How hard was it to actually get out? I mean, when? How long did it take to get out, and what did you have to do?
Well, we were just hunkered down for a few days and without knowing what was happening. But, you know, rumors started to filter through. And the absence of warfare in the air was a good sign.
Uh-huh.
And also that the shelling that the Egyptian artillery was doing, that stopped after the first day. And it was just a question of different rumors that we heard. For about 2, 3, 4 days, we had no idea what was going on. And I realized that my parents didn't know if we were dead or alive.
Right.
Because we had no means of communicating with them.
Right.
As I say, we had no telephone.
Right, right.
Anytime I talked to them on the phone, it was through a public phone at the university where I worked. And but I couldn't get there. Everything in the country came to a complete halt.
Right.
Because every able-bodied person, man and woman, was fighting. So the whole economy and the whole civic life of Israel came to a halt.
Yeah.
Because everybody was in the army.
Was there food? Were you able to? I mean, I guess I'm wondering just how horrible it was. How it was as the days went on.
Well, I don't remember that we were in any dire need of food.
Yeah.
I guess local stores were open, but they were selling what they had in stock already.
Right, sure.
I don't remember any kind of run on the stores or anything like that. But everybody stayed close to home.
Yeah.
And we got by. And after a few days, we began to hear rumors and finally reports on the BBC that Israel was doing very well in the war.
Yeah.
That Egypt had basically been defeated, that Jordan had been defeated, and after a few days, the fight switched to the north, where there was a border with Syria.
Uh-huh.
Syria had a border in the north called the Golan Heights, which was a high plateau, and they had artillery there where they used to lob shells into the Israeli settlements below, and there was very little that it was very hard to defend against.
Right.
And so the Israeli army had to basically scale the Golan Heights and fight the Syrians hand to hand, basically. And by the fifth and sixth day, they had succeeded in chasing the Syrian army out of the Golan Heights area. Actually, they were halfway to Damascus when the ceasefire took hold.
So people that you knew were fighting. I mean, so because so many of the military was people that you interacted with every day. I mean, were you aware of not knowing where your friends might be, or people that you worked with not knowing where they were?
Well, there was really only one. There was only one fellow I knew named Yitzhak who was fighting.
Yeah.
And you know, he came back alive and told us stories. Actually, he was fighting the Syrians. He was in the north.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we heard some battle stories, but I really didn't know a lot of people who had gone off to serve. I didn't, the people I worked with, well, most of them were women, older women, and
yeah,
not the ones who would have been in the army. I didn't know a lot of people who, and we were in a funny situation. A lot of the people we knew were Americans and Canadians, and
right.
We didn't have any real close relationships with native Israelis.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if you have been, in the last week or so, listening to any of the coverage and the stories and everything. A lot of people are talking about the Six-Day War, and I'm wondering if, I mean, the political climate in the United States, we're in a kind of a strange place in relation to the Middle East right now, and does the way people are talking about the Six-Day War, does it comport with the way you remember it? Do you feel like it's being covered accurately?
Well, actually, the only reportage I've paid attention to is a series that was on the internet, and it was put out by the Jerusalem Post and some other Israeli entities.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I don't know, it was about a dozen different videos. They were like 4 or 5 minutes long. And it's a chronological recapitulation of the events leading up to the war and then day by day through the war.
Yeah.
And that brought back a lot of memories.
I bet.
And as far as I can tell, it was very accurate.
Yeah.
One thing I remember when towards the end of the war, and it was only 6 days.
Right.
The Israeli army drove the Jordanians out of Jerusalem, and Jerusalem was, the two halves of Jerusalem were reunited. And after the war was over, we went walking in the old city of Jerusalem, and we saw the Western Wall.
Mm-hmm.
And all these Old Testament kind of places.
Yeah.
New Testament kind of places,
yeah,
too. And at that time, there was a beautiful popular song that was being played continually everywhere, Yerushalayim Shel Zahav, which means Jerusalem of Gold. It was a very lyrical, beautiful kind of thing. Everybody was listening to it and singing it.
Uh-huh.
And I'll tell you the truth, after 50 years, when I hear it, I choke up.
Yeah.
I'm choking up now.
I'll see if I can find a copy of it.
It just summed up the whole thing and the miraculous reunification of the city,
yeah,
after 2,000 years. It was really quite something.
Well, did you consider staying after that with all that feelings of unity? No.
No, we felt that this was something that was probably going to happen again,
mm-hmm,
which it did.
Yeah.
And we were not whatever we hoped to find in Israel, we were not finding.
Yeah.
And we decided that we should pick up and go home.
Yeah.
Which we did, like, a couple of months afterwards.
Yeah. Boy, and there's so much more to this story, too. I know this was sort of, there was a lot more adventures back in the United States before you settled down in New England, too, which we don't have time for today, unfortunately. We'll save that for another time. I have a silly question that I think I know the answer to, but I'm going to ask you anyway. At the Seder and Passover, the last song that we sing is, you know, L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim.
Next year in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think that means? Do you want to go back to Jerusalem, or?
Well, I would like to. I wouldn't mind going back for a visit.
Yeah.
But I think of it as symbolic of eternal life.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I look at it. As a Hebrew Catholic, when I think of it as heavenly Jerusalem, and that's what I'm singing about.
Yeah.
I'm not yearning to go back to earthly Jerusalem,
yeah,
but I am looking forward to heavenly Jerusalem.
Oh, well, so am I.
That
answers my question, and that's what I always thought when I sang it as well. Boy, I mean, I've never been there, but I feel like I've somehow inherited memories and some kind of longing for it. So,
yeah,
oh my goodness.
They talk about sometimes when American Jews come over, they're overtaken by this feeling for Jerusalem,
mm-hmm,
as if something mystical has happened to them, and they even have a psychological name for it in Hebrew. I think the Israelis laugh about it because.
Yeah, that must be strange.
Jerusalem, you know.
And they're all just talking about diarrhea.
Yeah, well, we were there 50 years ago. It's a very beautiful city.
Yeah.
Many of the buildings are built with this pink golden stone.
Ah.
And different light, different times of the day. It's really Jerusalem of gold really sums it up. It's a very beautiful city.
Oh.
And I would like to go back there, but I probably won't. But
this would be
maybe.
Who knows? Anything could happen. Oh, but thank you so much.
Right.
Thank you so much for I've always, all my whole life, I've been wanting to ask you more about. More to fill in some of these memories, and I'm so glad to know these things.
Okay, was there anything else? I mean,
oh boy, I don't know if there is. I'll follow up. Boy, the time went by fast.
Okay.
Yeah. Hey, thank you so much, and maybe I'll see you next Sunday.
Okay, sweetheart.
All right, take care of it.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.